But just as there are environmentally sustainable experts at the table, I think there could be culturally sustainable people at the table that are practitioners of invention, of In My Case Action, that would create a more vibrant urban environment. My name is Elizabeth Streb. I'm a choreographer, and I'm the director of SLAM, Streb Lab for Action Mechanics, in Brooklyn, New York. What if you just invented more elaborate and imaginative action machines for the general public? I became dismayed that the dance world and movement, where everybody is encumbered with either the necessity to do movement or the adjoining ecstasy of moving. And I feel that we failed as a field to embrace the necessity to understand what the civic needs of the human body that inhabit New York City are. Well, in a certain way, if I had my way, parks, the segregation of parks where they are discrete areas where you do certain things like have picnics, take your children, relax because there are trees. I think that a more beautiful way to make a park would be to take Central Park and put it in an enormous shaker and throw it over the entire city so you have smaller areas of parks that everybody gets to cross. The overt planning I was less attracted to. I like the idea that you could come upon an area that seemed accidental. And I think people, the general heart of humans, you're drawn towards a less planned out environment. But obviously it's enormously planned. But it just doesn't have the veneer of planning, which I always think contributes to a certain class, a very constrained class designation where you are invited and you are not. And if it ends up looking like kind of a area that has been ultimately abandoned, it seems that people flock to it. You know, if it's not dangerous, et cetera. So I think that my notion of the where and why will people gather in the 21st century was what I was trying to be drawn to amidst all of those different proposals. Well, I think that the general, there were a very, as you can see, a very diverse panel of life skills, from city planning, architects, urban designers, landscape architects. And I think that if I was going to pick a common denominator, it was for the people, you know, for the youth groups of New York that want to go there. So I did not know what a berm was before I went to this panel. So that was an education. But the notion of what the function of the berms were, which was to shield a lot of the residents from the noise and the clamor of the traffic, there was much discussion about how to reinvent the berms and to still instill safety for the residents or not. I don't, myself, care about city quiet. I think that that's a privileged condition that most people don't have, so I had no affinity with it whatsoever. I think that if you live in an urban environment, you're a different kind of animal. And I don't believe in creating suburbia in an urban environment, because that privileged space, in my opinion, has been a failure for the development of humans sort of having healthy and productive exchanges. For me, what I'm interested in is taking an economic cross-section of the whole culture of New York City. It was very much what Jane Jacobs believed, that you cross-pollinate economic needs and uses and make it available for everyone. And so in terms of the cross, I wouldn't have privileged the people who live there. In terms of the traffic, I have to admit, is not my specialty. I was learning a lot. I would say that the major conversation was traffic. And I think that when you speak to the other jurists, some of them are so fluent in traffic science, transportation science. The two first prizes that we all chose had some brilliant ideas about unifying the traffic flow and simplifying it, rather than all of that madcap directionality that occurs around the park. I think that parks are designed and controlled by people who rule, ultimately. They're the ones, especially in New York City, and certainly in Brooklyn. I don't think that that will change. I think that the history of the design of Grand Army was definitely considered, and there were varying degrees of reverence for that and wanting to highlight the memory of that original plan. But in terms of talking about the demographics of each of the abutting neighborhood groups, in my memory, there wasn't a huge amount of discussion based on that. Because I think that people think that because of the Botanical Gardens, because of Prospect Park, because of the museum, the entire city ends up funneling into this, the use group that will be ending up and grant, whatever this design ends up being. And even if it ever gets built, I think the conversation obviously has to happen first. So I think if you decide you're going to design this for the whole entire urban area, then it's for everybody, and it probably will usually upset the more privileged. It's difficult because I struggle with the park idea in terms of my own. My interest has become something that ends up trying to make public cultural institutions really public, to examine the distinction between what is public and what is private. And my analysis so far has shown that what is really public, in other words, paid for by taxpayers' money, is actually being used in a privatized way. And so my experiment here is a continuing experiment that where we're just sort of watching the slime mold germinate on the ground, and it's shocking what it's revealing to us, that people really don't feel invited or privileged into most theaters, into most museums, if you go into theaters and you look at the demographics, you'll see it's mostly white upper class, old people, my age and older. If you go into the parks, I don't go into the parks. So is it used by everybody more so than Lincoln Center? Probably. But I'm more interested in an area where there's something that's constant, that is used on a constant basis. Not that an artist gets commissioned and puts the gates in Central Park, or puts, you know, a two-day performance on at Summer Stage, or what might happen here. I would love the idea that there would be a germination of something that has constancy to it, that people come to the way they go to the ocean and not have to know about it in advance. It's just something that becomes part of people's everyday lives. I have no idea what the architecture or structure of that phenomenon, creating that phenomenon, might be, except for what we're doing here and what I'm learning about switching over from a very privatized art operation into a public art enterprise, which is what I consider SLAM to be. But I think that the issue of attention span and what, when people have events in the park, for instance, it usually has chairs facing the stage. And so people are more or less required, you know, to pay attention. Rather than an issue where in here we are examining audience behavior and what it is people really want to do. They can see kids, young people, your age people. They can see what's going on without being quiet in the dark and looking. Like they could be having their picnic on the blanket and knowing that something's going on over here, just like the ocean at the beach, and not need have the permission to not need to pay attention to it in the way that we traditionally pay attention to lifetime arts. And in terms of being able to design an event space that isn't such a public space, which is outdoors or in a park, because of the way we're fiscally constructed for culture in the United States, it's when I went into Grand Central Terminal, I spent $100,000. I'm a company, you know, separate from being able to use the space, which was great, but enormous. We were there for a month, but enormously impractical, you know. So I think that the fiscal boundaries and the fiscal issues that fall both on the probably park management and companies that might inhabit it at varying times are separate from what physical structure would allow somebody to implant their event in a park. I think the constraints are, at this point, I see them as more fiscal. But what would it look like? I don't know.